It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth. Denali National Park is 100 years old. That's a fair bit of history in a state that's barely 50. Even today, many people seem to think of Alaska as being inexhaustible. What was happening a century ago in this place with so little population to make leaders decide to save this particular area for the future? And how has that belief evolved over the decades as the tourism industry grew and the wildlife became the stars of millions of snapshots? We're also going to talk about Denali issues today and about how you can enjoy the park. Alaskans may forget we have some of America's best national parkland open for us to enjoy year-round. As the 100th birthday approaches and events are planned, join us in a conversation about Denali. And to begin with, we're going to talk about the history, because obviously the 100th anniversary of the centennial is a time to look back and think about how this extraordinary decision happened. If you think about it, Alaska, from the perspective of the newcomers, the white settlers, was one big, huge wilderness, and yet the decision was made that this particular area was going to be a national park. And to talk about that, I have with me on the line from Denali, Eric Johnson, who's the park historian, and spends his time studying the history of the park and interpreting it for visitors. Thanks for being with us, Eric.
Thanks for having me. I'm happy to be here to tell the story.
So let's go back in time to before the park was started. And, you know, as you look at it now, it's still a sort of a Pleistocene landscape that's pretty much untouched by human hand other than the park road and a few buildings. And so you can get this feeling of, like, that's what it always looked like. But when you think of the first settlers coming, obviously not the Native Americans, but the people coming from the south, looking at that area, kind of all of Alaska looked like that, right? I mean, there wasn't really anything here yet in terms of buildings and roads and all that stuff. You know, what was the first, how did this story begin? Where does it start out?
Well, the story of Denali, as far as a national park, as you said, we started 100 years ago, but the park creation story goes back about probably 10 years before that is where we trace it from the records. A man named Charles Sheldon, who was a wealthy Easterner who had retired in his 30s, had come to study doll sheep as a part of the U.S. Biological Survey. And he came to the northern region of the northern region of the Alaska Range in the Denali area, and was studying doll sheep, had been guided by a man named Harry Karstens, who eventually would become the park's first superintendent. But during this time, he was studying the wildlife, but he also was meeting people in the northwest region of what we now know as the park, a little area called Kantishna. Kantishna was a mining community that had boomed in 1905.
Now, it wasn't totally deserted, was it? That was, and as I recall, that the gold up there was, if I'm remembering correctly, was actually discovered by Judge James Wickersham when he was first poking around up there soon after the turn of the century.
Correct. So Wickersham had the first recorded attempt at Denali Summit in 1903, and on his return to Fairbanks, he didn't make it to the summit, but on his return, he found gold in the northern area of the Kantishna Hills, and it sort of sparked the gold rush. So really, this story, if you go back,
yeah,
in 1898, the Klondike Gold Rush sort of spilled over into Alaska. Several gold rushes popped up. Kantishna was one of these outgrowths of the Klondike Gold Rush.
Right, and there were these little gold rush outposts all over that have disappeared. You know, that if you look at a map of Alaska, there's a lot of towns on the map that don't exist, and these were all little gold rush towns that started. Maybe there was gold there, maybe there wasn't, and then they were abandoned. And I guess Kantishna is one that, at least, you know, at one time sort of was, there was some real gold mining there, huh?
Right. So Kantishna's had several boom cycles, 1905, 1906, again in the 1920s, they tried to mine there in the late 1930s until the start of World War II, there was a big boom. The problem was always how remote the area was, and it was never cost effective to mine gold. It was mostly placer gold, There was some antimony mining that happened in the area, especially during war. Antimony was used to manufacture ammunition. So as early as 1905, due to the Russo-Japanese War, there was some antimony mining in Kantishna. And then again in World War I era and the World War II era, you see antimony mines popping up. And gold mining continues in Kantishna. Even last summer,
there was really?
a miner operating in the El Dorado Creek area who had an in-holding and legally was able to mine. Most of the mining ended in 1985 after an injunction was filed. But mining has been a part of the history, and it's a very important part of the creation story of Denali National Park because if we go back to Sheldon, he had come to the region. He met on his way to Denali from Fairbanks. He went through the Kantishna mining camps. He met some of the locally famous miners like Fannie Quigley and Joe Quigley and developed relationships with them, realized that, you know, what they needed to survive in a remote area was the ability to hunt. And he was here as a part of the U.S. Biological Survey, and he was trying to study Dall sheep, but he was, you know, he was noticing that the presence of mining and the presence of market hunters who were feeding, you know, the town of Fairbanks, they were taking a lot of game from this area, which he realized was, you know, a special place, lots of moose, caribou, Dall sheep, grizzly bears, and he was alarmed at the rate of which the wildlife was being hunted. So
I've always thought this was an interesting little chapter in Alaska history that that we don't think of we think of Alaska being very abundant in those days, but actually people were hunting wildlife as just food that was being sold in town in markets, and that was true elsewhere in the American West too. And some of the original conservationists who came were in fact, you know, Boone and Crockett Club members, you know, sort of friends of Teddy Roosevelt, and they had a sportsman perspective on hunting, and they really didn't like this kind of use of wildlife. They preferred to have wildlife sort of kept for their sportsman activities. And if you look at it from a kind of a class perspective, it's a little bit maybe not the way we would like it, right? We don't want to think about it's just sort of the rich hunters coming in and telling the working class hunters what not to do. On the other hand, if they hadn't done that, wildlife was really being decimated, and they really needed to do it. And if you see pictures from those days of these enormous takes of wildlife, of just massive, massive numbers of dead animals, you realize that that couldn't have gone on. And so it sounds like Sheldon was really on the side of those sort of upper class hunters who were offended by that.
Yeah, so you make a great point. And what was unique about Sheldon, he had a knack for relating to the people that weren't of his class. So he was a member of the Boone and Crockett Club. He was a member of the Eastern Elite, and he had those connections that would enable him to get park legislation passed. But he also was the type of guy who, you know, he came in the Kantishna. He mingled with the local miners, and he knew what those needs were. He wasn't somebody that was turning his nose up at the locals.
Sure.
Harry Karstens, who was his guide, he had been in Alaska since the Klondike, and he worked very hard as a mail carrier and a prospector himself. And right away, Sheldon had earned Karstens' respect as a hard worker, somebody that wasn't going to, you know, just hire somebody to do all his dirty work. He actually got involved in the dirty work himself. And because of that, he earned a respect among the locals. And it was a combination of understanding the local needs and his connections in the East that enabled his success, really. Sheldon, after his time, and so as I said, if we go back to 1906 to 1908, that's when he was studying the sheep. We have a record of him calling for a Denali National Park in one of his journals. In a January 1908 entry, he talks about the future Denali National Park. And we know that he goes back to the Boone and Crockett Club in New York and pitches this idea. And this is about late 1908, early 1909. But at that time, there was a change in administration. And
this is when Teddy Roosevelt left office and handed over to William Howard Taft, as I recall.
Yeah, exactly. And so for whatever reason at that time, the park idea got shelved. I've read that it could have been due to the change in administration. There's also something I've read about George Bird Grinnell, who was another famous Boone and Crockett Club member, early conservationist, ethnographer. He was interested in getting Glacier National Park established, and that was sort of the project that was on the minds of Boone and Crockett Club at that time.
But let me stop you just for a second, Eric, because it seems to me that we just celebrated the centennial of the National Park Service itself last year, right? So there wasn't really a National Park Service in existence at that point, right?
Right. So the agency was not in existence yet. The national parks were being sort of loosely managed in the Department of the Interior.
Oh, I see. Hmm.
However, the people that were important in the Department of Interior were connected to Charles Sheldon. And another man who ends up being a part of the early story is Belmore Brown. He was well connected to the people in the East. And Belmore Brown and Charles Sheldon, I think unbeknownst to each other, were both after this idea of Denali National Park. Belmore Brown had attempted to summit Denali three different times, almost got there in 1912, but was turned away by a fierce blizzard. But he was a conservationist and artist, and he would be involved in getting the park idea to the finish line.
Was it just the fact that it was the tallest mountain in North America? Is that what made him want to put a park there? Or what were, when you go back and look at their writings, what were their main reasons?
For Sheldon, it was absolutely protection of the wildlife. I think Brown and Sheldon and James Wickersham, who ended up being involved in drafting the legislation, they all knew that because the mountain was there, that was definitely an important component of the legislation and why this area was important. But for them, it always came back to protecting the game. They had seen railroads, another westward expansion, wipe out famously the American bison in the West and another species. And they saw, and really the impetus for them really getting moving in 1914, 1915 was the Alaska Railroad. President Wilson had selected a interior route that that flanked Broad Pass. The railroad started in Seward.
As we know it today, yeah.
As we know it today, the alignment we know today, it was going to be going near the region that both Belmore Brown and Charles Sheldon were worried about. And they thought once there was better access for hunters, and even the railroad camps themselves would create a demand for meat in the area, and they were very concerned about what the presence of that railroad meant. And that sort of, that really spurred them into action in 1915.
Right. I can imagine. And it was a big national issue. Everybody knew what was going on, and it took 8 years to build the railroad. So they had a little time to finish what they're doing. This is so interesting. And we're talking about the history of Denali National Park, which was created 100 years ago. And my guest is Eric Johnson, who's a park historian. My name is Charles Wolforth, and the show is Outdoor Explorer. I want to hear more about the legislation and how it finally passed, but I think Wickersham is such an interesting character because he was kind of an adventurer, and he had actually explored the area that became Olympic National Park before he came to Alaska, and then explored where Denali was, and then he became a judge. Had the courthouse in Eagle, and then moved the courthouse to Fairbanks, which kind of established Fairbanks as a permanent community, and then was elected delegate to Congress for the territory and represented Alaska and was a key figure in starting the Alaska Railroad. So it's interesting to me that he also was an advocate for the park. It shows that he had a lot of different aspects to his personality.
Yes, Wickersham was an extremely important figure in the creation of the park. And I don't know, I don't know that Wickersham initially was warm to the park idea. He knew the area was special, and he had written about that in some of his memoirs. But Sheldon understood at the time that Wickersham becomes Alaska's territorial delegate in 1909, I believe. And Wickersham had also been at, he had been hosted at Boone and Crockett Club dinners, and Sheldon knew him, and he knew that if he had Wickersham's support, you know, a man who was so well connected in Alaska, that this bill could become a reality. And so he, from his earliest, if you read Sheldon's letters in 1915, you can tell that his objective is to get Wickersham on board with the bill and have Wickersham's input, because he doesn't, he knows that he needs Alaskan support for this to happen. And Wickersham, you know, has his, he's an elected official, so he understands people's needs, and he doesn't want to alienate the Alaskan population. So Wickersham becomes an important part of drafting the bill. Wickersham ends up introducing the bill to the House of Representatives in April of 1916, and an identical bill was introduced to the Senate by a man named Key Pittman, who was a senator from Nevada. And both these bills are debated a couple weeks later. They have hearings, and we learn a lot about what people want, what senators want from the bill, you know. And as you said at the top of the segment, we're in this remote area. Why does it matter to a bunch of legislators in Washington, D.C.? Well, this is where a lot of the proponents make their case. And Sheldon had formed Sheldon and Brown had formed a coalition, one with Wickersham, but also he had the railroad people, William Eads, who was the chair of the Alaska Engineering Commission, and Thomas Riggs, who also was involved in drafting legislation. They were both railroad men, and they had them testify in support of the bill. In a weird way, the railroad was causing Sheldon, it was causing him anxiety about the state of the game. But the railroad was also a reason to convince legislators in Washington that a national park could be accessed.
Could help sell tickets on the railroad, right? Yeah, this is something that I don't think folks realize, is that tourism was already a big deal 100 years ago, and that was one of the reasons for the National Parks of the West being created, is so that the railroads would have somewhere to go and take passengers and sell tickets and sell hotel rooms, so folks could go out and see places like Yellowstone and the Grand Canyon and Yosemite on their railroad trips. And so the railroad barons ended up being advocates for conservation in that way.
Yeah. The railroads need the national parks, and the national parks need the railroads, because, you know, a lot of these, you know, if you read the Senate hearings, you're like, why are we creating this national park that nobody can, you know, access? And then all of a sudden it's like, well, we have this railroad coming through, so people will be able to access it. The railroad's also the reason we need to protect the area, because the camps are going to destroy the game. But they really did need each other. And, you know, if you go back and look at the newspaper ads from the late 1800s and early 1900s, oftentimes the railroad are using the national parks as an advertising tool.
So did the bill just slide right on through?
It did not slide right on through. There were some, there were a few hangups. One of the delays was, it was an informal House rule that said that only two national park bills per year could be considered for passage. And this is in 1916. And that year, Hawaii Volcanoes National Park and Lassen Volcano National Park were already on the docket. So, because of this informal rule, the bill was shelved for most of 1916. After the bill was introduced, there was some debate over the language in the bill. Unique to what at that time was the Mount McKinley National Park bill was the Section 6 provision, which allowed miners to hunt within the boundaries of the proposed national park. And this was one of Sheldon's way. It was one of Sheldon's ways of assuaging the people that were not interested in having federal government in Alaska.
We were already having those fights 100 years ago, right? Which we continue to have. So those Kantishna folks that didn't want to be cut out,
Yeah, these fights go way back. You have this idea that federal government's coming in to manage your land, and people immediately become worried about what rights they're going to have left. And so they took great care to put provisions in the bill to make sure that miners and prospectors were not going to be negatively affected. What happens is that provision was unique to Mount McKinley National Park, and lots of conservationists had problems with it, but Sheldon and Brown were interested in getting a bill passed, and they knew that they had to make compromises to have that happen. So the bill gets taken back up in early 1917. The House ends up passing it in the Senate. Well, the Senate version of the bill passes. The House passes it out on February 19th, and then Wilson signs the bill on February 26th. I should say there was a lot of help along the way. Sheldon was connected to people in publishing. There was famously a National Geographic article that came out in January of 1917. It was written by a geologist named Stephen Capps, who had done a lot of survey work in the Kantishna area, and he wrote an article that put in stark terms the state of wildlife.
Interesting. So journalists have been part of this conservation effort for a long time. It's not a new deal.
Right. And so there were lots of people. Stephen Mather, who was the first, he was the first director of the National Park Service. He was very helpful in using his connections to get publications and, arm twisting of congressmen and senators, that sort of thing. And it's pretty phenomenal that the United States was not yet in World War I, but World War I was going on, and they were going to join the war in April of 1917, but that they were able to get a park bill passed during that time.
They were able to think about two things at once in those days. Impressive. So, the early years of the park, I get the impression that there wasn't that much that happened, right? I mean, it was still a very remote area, and it probably took a while for it to really become a tourist destination.
Yeah, so they get the park bill passed, and as I mentioned about the war, there wasn't a high priority to actually fund the park. So you had the train that was being built, but it was very difficult to access the region. In order to access the area, you had to take, in the winter, take a team of dogs, or in the summer, you'd have to travel by river. A lot of the access happened through the Kantishna area. And until the train was built, it was really difficult for tourists to get here. And that, because there was no access and because war was going on, there were other concerns in Washington, but they didn't get an appropriation through until 1921.
Just very, very quiet. And then it slowly grew, and it became a destination for people coming up on the Alaska Railroad. And it stayed a railroad park primarily, I guess, until the 1970s. And then, just in the couple of minutes we have left, I mean, the other big event, probably the other biggest event in the history of Denali was passage of Anilka in 1980 or 81, I believe, when the park was dramatically increased in size and changed in name, right? It was Mount McKinley National Park, and then it became Denali.
That's correct. And so I would point out, in 1957, the old Denali Highway was completed, which gave road access to, which gave road access from Fairbanks and Anchorage, but it wasn't, as you said, not until the George Parks Highway was completed in 72 to where real traffic and visitor increases happen.
So you would drive up the Richardson Highway to Paxson and then cut across on the Denali Highway on gravel. That must have been quite the journey.
Exactly. And those roads weren't improved too much. So I imagine people have pretty good stories of trying to make that journey.
Wow, it's quite the story. And I want to thank you for being here, Eric. It's been fascinating. I've actually learned a lot, and I'm sure our listeners have too, about sort of the conservation struggles that were taking place a century ago. And so thanks for being with us today, Eric Johnson.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, Eric is a park historian at Denali National Park. And in a few minutes, we're going to be hearing from John Quinley about what you can find at the park today if you decide to go up for a visit. I think you'll find that an interesting conversation and also some of the controversies that are ongoing. But first, we're going to hear a segment that was produced by our Indy Alaska team here at Alaska Public Media. They went out with some researchers who were studying, again, the same animals that Sheldon was studying so many years earlier. And we'll hear the audio from that Indy Alaska episode, which is quite interesting. And if you want to see the video, it's like senseless to do a Denali National Park show without having any images. Please go to our website at outdoorexplorer.org and click on today's show on the Denali Centennial, and you can watch the video for this Indy Alaska segment. And stick with us as Outdoor Explorer continues.
So today we are surveying doll sheep in the park. Now I see a couple ewes and lambs. Oh, they're frolicking. It's so cute. We get out the scope, we get out the optics, try to count, is that a ewe with kind of largish horns, or is that a young male, Trying to make those finer distinctions to make our data as accurate as possible.
You said you only see three. I thought I saw four in there too.
Specifically trying to get, as best we can, a sense of how many lambs there are per 100 ewes is the standard measurement. Yeah, I'd probably call that a yearling, which is basically looking at kind of how's the reproductive success.
My name is Michael Raffaelli. I'm a jack of all trades in the National Park Service.
I'm Kaya Clotter, and today at least I'm a wildlife technician. I feel like until I get the master's, I don't know that I can quite full out say I'm a wildlife biologist. I grew up in Palmer, Alaska. One thing I really discovered when I was living in Lower 48, which is what we call the rest of the country, was that everywhere felt just like a little bit claustrophobic to me.
And I've always identified as a Californian, and you hear people that move here and it's like, well, how long do you have to be here to be an Alaskan? And I say I live in Alaska, I think that's the way to say it. I live here now, and that transition has been interesting. And I don't know what it would be like to go back to California. I think that's where, when I talk to people, they say, oh, that's the harder transition, because all of a sudden you realize everything that's so important. For me, it's the open space that I can look out my window and see for miles and know that there's no roads and that we have these wild areas.
Actually, part of the reason that this park was initially formed was that people were seeing the large numbers of sheep here, that it was really good habitat.
Charles Sheldon was a hunter. That's what originally drew him up here to Alaska. Those sheep were being hunted not only for a couple of specimens, but people were coming in potentially decimating the population.
Especially with market hunting as the area was being developed, the railroad, a lot of them were being killed to feed those camps.
Him seeing that and saying, wait a second, we're not gonna have these sheep in the future unless we do something about it now. It was ultimately the power of his passion, and he affected somebody else, and that affected somebody else, and that affected somebody else, to ultimately create a huge national park that hundreds of thousands of people come to visit every year. I feel lucky to have that opportunity to go out and take the time to look at them, even if they are just little white dots, and remember what those little white dots represent. His first trip, of course, where we were hiking, is where he shot his first sheep, was on Cathedral Mountain.
Obviously the park is much too large to effectively ground survey all of it. I mean, it's 6 million acres, it's just not gonna happen. So basically, what they wanna do is say, okay, we're gonna look at kind of a subsample, see what that number looks like.
And groups divide up, hiking in groups of two or three people, and walk around surveying the area that's likely sheep habitat.
These canyons are so steep and twisted that, your one vantage point might be all you ever get.
But with the binoculars, just happen to see on the ridge line looking, oh, couple of white dots that I probably wouldn't have noticed otherwise, and sure enough, ended up being another nursery group.
We're on the south part of Cathedral Mountain right now, which is very sheepy. There's, I mean, the steep terrain, which they like, but there's also, you know, enough vegetation that they can be feeding on that. Nothing has space anything like Alaska does. And that's, to me, that's a really special feeling. And it's a little bit of a paradoxical feeling, because I know that me being here enjoying it is one person making that space just a little bit smaller. But I hope that places like Denali are able to facilitate people's interactions with wild areas in ways that aren't very destructive.
The parks and the Park Service, kind of, they're that piece that we have to keep asking ourselves, is this important to us? And we have to continually answer that, and it's important that every generation engages in those discussions.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on KSKA Anchorage. The program repeats next Thursday at 8 p.m. on FM 91.1. Connect with Outdoor Explorer anytime. Download podcasts and see what's coming up on future programs by going to our website at alaskapublic.org.
It's Outdoor Explorer, and I'm Charles Woolforth. We're talking today about Denali National Park, which started 100 years ago. Actually started as Mount McKinley National Park, I believe, and its name was changed around 1980 when a big land bill passed, and it grew, and it's had lots of history beyond just the beginning of it. We heard a lot about the history in the first half, and now I want to learn more about going to the park, current events there. Maybe you've kind of forgotten about Denali as a destination for the summer. There's some cool stuff happening this spring there that you could get involved in. And my guest to talk about all this is John Quinley, who for many years has been the communication person for the National Park Service regionally here in Anchorage. Thanks for being here, John.
Happy to be here. Thank you.
So let's start talking about, like, visiting the park. And I feel like there's been enough change in the last couple of decades that some people may have sort of forgotten about this as being our national park. It's an Alaskan national park, and you could actually get in your car and be there. It doesn't take too long, and right. You could really have a fantastic weekend there. You don't have to turn it over to the tourists, right? The tourists are great. We're glad they're here, but it's also a great place for Anchorage residents to go.
It is, and a lot of them do that, and there's certainly room for more. You know, when I first came up here in the early 1980s, the bus system was basically a poker chip that you got. It's gotten a little more sophisticated with online reservations mm-hmm. now, but it's still after the first 15 miles of the road, it's largely people going in on shuttle and tour buses. But there's a lot of park to explore that doesn't need a bus ticket, and those areas have particularly been developed. The opportunities developed over the last dozen to 20 years in the front country of the park, as we call it.
Yeah. So when we think about 100 years ago, it's almost amazing to think that they protected a national park, because all of Alaska was complete wilderness, right? And then somebody, you know, as we learned in the first half, some people had the foresight saying that, okay, this special place is going to be a park. Then as time went on, there was a railroad built, and then there was a road built, more and more pressure for people to get into these backcountry areas. And the Park Service came up with a system to essentially limit the number of people who get into that backcountry using the road and the bus system. And maybe just briefly explain how that shuttle system works. So it's a metering system, right?
Largely, yeah. It began in shortly after the year after the completion of the George Parks Highway in 1972. So prior to that, it was a long drive to get to Denali, or a train ride from Anchorage. With the completion of the highway between Anchorage and Fairbanks, visitation and use of the park jumped dramatically, and that's when the shuttle bus system came in, partly to limit the amount of traffic so that wildlife would be available, but also just the narrow and rugged road is not
you wouldn't want
really
a lot
built
of cars
for
on it. Yeah.
What's now 600,000 visitors a year. That would be mm-hmm. a disaster.
Right.
So the bus system's been in place since the early 70s, and there are essentially parallel bus systems going into the interior of the park. There's a tour bus that you buy a ticket, and typically it goes out to to Stony Overlook, just a little shy of the Eielson Visitor Center. There's a couple of variations on that theme. But you stay on the same bus. There's a sack lunch, a narrator, a driver. They sort of guarantee to get you back on time.
If you're on that bus, nothing against tourists, but most of the people there are going to be cruise ship passengers or other visitors. Yeah.
Right. That tends to be where the sort of the package tour folks go. Then the sort of parallel bus system is the shuttle, which works more like if you have a ticket on a day ticket on a city bus where you can get on and off almost anywhere you want. You buy a ticket. The price varies depending how far west you ultimately want to go. But if you see a spot where you want to get off and hike, take a picnic lunch, just get off the bus and stretch your legs, you can do that, spend some time off the park road, come back and flag down the next bus and be on your way either direction.
Right. So I used to write travel guidebooks, and I wrote one that covered national parks all over the country and then also books about Alaska. And I grew up in Alaska, and I didn't realize just how amazing this opportunity was until I'd been to many other parks, because other parks, grew up in the age of the road, and there's a lot of car-oriented visiting in other parks. Some, like Great Smoky, are sort of like choked with cars. And here, what you've got is almost like a Serengeti safari that would cost you, if you went to Africa, would cost you many thousands of dollars. But here you can do it for a bus ticket that anybody can afford, and then you can get off and be by yourself in the wilderness. And that's sort of what I think people don't pick up on, is that Denali is the opportunity that you would otherwise need to have a plane to fly into the wilderness to really get out there, or you would need, an ATV, or you need something that costs you a lot of money, a lot of planning. But here you can do it just by driving up, getting a bus ticket, maybe get it on the internet so that you know the ticket will be there, ride out there, and you are in deep wilderness with not that many other people.
Right. The majority of people, while all those opportunities you described are absolutely available, lots of people stay on the bus or pretty close to where a stone's throw from the road itself. Uh-huh. So if you're mildly adventurous, there are lots of wonderful hikes that you can take by getting off the bus.
If you walk a mile, you're going to be by yourself.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
Pretty much. Yeah. And there's lots of opportunities to do that. The other sort of bus system, if you will, is around the entrance area. Mm-hmm. And there are free shuttle buses in the entrance area. And so opportunities to park your car and not drive, but still get around to out to Savage River. There's some great hiking opportunities, including a new Savage Alpine Trail. Campgrounds, of course, the visitor center, the sled dog demonstrations, which in the summer there are three times a day and are hugely popular. And
kids really love that.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's dogs that are amenable to being petted. They've got puppies often during the middle of the year.
We've got puppies. Okay.
We've got puppies, right? I mean, I really need to say, can the interview end?
What else?
We've
what
got
else
puppies.
You need? Yeah, right. Right. Yeah. Well, there was a little bit of a philosophical shift maybe that occurred because there was a philosophy of, Denali is going to be a park without trails. And the idea was, if we got this shuttle bus system that can drop you on this immense area of wilderness and you can hike anywhere you want on the tundra, why do you need trails? But then at some point, people were creating their own, right? And
right.
So then you had to have a new way of looking at things.
That's true. And it is still largely a trail-less park. But there are some that we have developed for just the reasons that you've described. Around the Eielson Visitor Center, we've hardened a couple of trails because we had a whole spaghetti network of trails. And it was clear that was going to just get worse over time as thousands of people visit every year. Mm-hmm. So there's some trails now developed out of the Eielson Visitor Center around Savage River, a great hike to the north downstream along Savage River, and then back there's a bridge, and then back the other side. It's, a couple mile round trip, but a really easy, accessible trail.
Great family thing to do.
Like it
is. If you're just getting started, you don't have to go off into the into the middle of nowhere. You can actually follow a trail and be at Denali and have some fabulous views.
Right. Another favorite is, if you come up and see the visit the sled dogs, if you're left your car or camped down at the lower end, down the hill at Riley Creek, there's a couple of trails that head down the hill. So mm-hmm. you can ride the bus going up and have largely a downhill hike back to the visitor center area.
Sweet. Mm. So there's a lot to do, and I want to talk about more of it, but also information is an important part of visiting the park, because unlike going to, say, Chugach National Forest or Chugach State Park, where there's a trail, there's not much, you know, you just walk on the trail and do whatever you're going to do. There's all these activities. There's ranger-led hikes. There's buses. There's the different spots. There's camping. And so you kind of need to plan a little bit, or at least have an idea of what you're doing. Where do you get that information?
A couple of good spots. The park has an extensive website, which is nps.gov/DENA, the first four letters of Denali.
And we'll put that on outdoorexplorer.org if folks are looking.
Great. Yeah. The other, for, you know, convenient for folks in Anchorage, would be the Alaska Public Lands Information Center on mm-hmm. 4th Avenue and F Street. And there they've got park brochures and maps, an experienced staff that can, you know, sort of connect what you want to do with what's available and how to do it. So those are probably your two best ways.
And the Public Land Information Center, again, is something that locals may not really keep in top of mind. Probably if you have kids, they've been there on a field trip.
Right.
But maybe you've never been there. And there's no shame in not knowing things, right? Asking a question is actually a smart thing to do if you're going outdoors. And I've done it. I've gone down there and said, hey, I've been thinking about this trip, you know, what do you think? And there's going to be people there who have done that exact trip and can talk you through it. And that's, wow, what an amazing resource that is, right? You don't have to find somebody who's done it. You can, like, go to, like, a public employee who's going to explain it to you.
Yeah.
And all the maps and all the
And they've got a lot of the other sort of collateral that can mm-hmm. help mm-hmm. you with that. It's 4th and F Street in the old federal building. You know, the other thing I think I should mention too is that we have Denali Park, as well as the rest of the park system in Alaska, has a lot of business partners that provide commercial visitor services. So, you know, we've been talking mainly about the park entrance area. There are air taxi operators out of Anchorage and Talkeetna that do flights into the Alaska Range, and you don't have to be a hardcore mountaineer to enjoy mm-hmm. them. There are rafting trips along the Nanana River on the eastern side of Denali. There's businesses in Kantishna. So there's a lot of other opportunities there to see part of the park, to have a guide, to have someone fly you in, because mm-hmm. most of us don't have airplanes.
Right. Though those opportunities are the sort of the higher end in terms of money,
right.
Whereas what the Park Service does tends to be inexpensive, available to anyone.
Right. That's right. Yeah.
So do you still do those ranger-led hikes where you can sign up for a hike and actually ride the bus out, and then you hike with a ranger, and maybe it's narrated to some extent, or a naturalist hike out in the park?
We do. The Discovery Hikes, or the Disco Hikes, which I think that name might have developed. We may be dating ourselves think that that's a fun name. So the Disco Hikes are still done in the summer. And mm-hmm. Then there are some other ranger-led programs in the entrance area as well. Another fun thing that for families at the main park visitor center, you can have the kids work on a junior ranger packet of you know, quiz questions and activities, and come away with a junior ranger badge when you finish the program. Doesn't take long. It's free. And you can also check out some gear to make that a richer experience.
Do you guys have what they have at a lot of parks, which is a sort of a partner organization that gives sort of longer classes or activities that, you know, multi-day sort of activities?
We do. The through Alaska Geographic and the MIRI Science and Learning Center, there are both one-day and longer courses, and those are a great way to explore a subject in depth in the park. And they've got their 2017 offerings online a nice range of activities. So that's another good way to explore the park in a little more depth.
So if a family is thinking about heading up to Denali for the weekend or a long weekend or something, how far ahead should you kind of start planning things out if you want to make sure you get a campsite and you get a good, you know, bus time and stuff like that? Is it something where you need to, if I'm thinking about it 2 weeks ahead, is it like, is that not enough time, or do you have a sense of that?
I guess our standard recommendation is sort of do it as far in advance as you have a idea of what your actual dates are going to be, mm-hmm. just so that you've got it and you don't have to worry about it. That said, you know, Denali had somewhere near 600,000 visitors last year, and most days you could show up at the park and within a fairly short period be able to be on a bus. It may not have been the time that you had in mind, but there was access into the interior of the park. Campsites get filled up a little more. Those are harder to come by on a short-term basis. There's some commercial campgrounds outside the park as well that are available. So, you know, as long and as far in advance as you can is sort of our main advice. I have given that advice to family and had, my sister's in-laws showed up with no reservations at all. I was sort of rolling my eyes like, okay, you know, they don't believe the Park Service guy. And of course, you know, they drove up and, you know, were on a bus 45 minutes later and found a campsite and had a wonderful time. It's like, okay, well, so much for all my good advice.
Right,
but that sometimes can be the exception. And particularly if you're on a tight schedule, if you know, making it a 3-day weekend or 4-day weekend, I'd recommend you get reservations in advance.
Yeah, get reservations in advance, but don't necessarily be scared off if it's Thursday afternoon and you say, hey, let's get out of here. Maybe it'll work.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And there's going to be somewhere to camp.
Yeah.
But,
yeah.
Yeah. All right. It's Outdoor Explorer. We are talking about Denali National Park today, and it's the centennial of the park. Centennial has just passed, and there's activities taking place. And, of course, the history of the park continues. There's issues that are going on right now about how the park should be managed and the wildlife and all of that. My guest right now is John Quinley, who has been with the National Park Service for a long time and knows all the facts, as you've been hearing. So, John, what kind of stuff is going on to actually celebrate the centennial? I guess it's getting started now, right? The different events you're doing.
The actual 100th anniversary was the 26th of February, and that happened in the middle of Winterfest, which is the annual winter activity in the park and in the community. And that was a wonderful several-day series of events. We're going to do Summerfest in early June, in the 10th of June. And again, a mix of in-park activities and Denali-focused activities in the community. Coming up April 15th to the 23rd is National Park Week nationwide. And on the two weekends that sort of bookend that, the park will be having some ranger-led bicycle riding trips down the park road.
Oh, cool. Winter biking with a guide, huh?
It's sort of the transition between winter and spring. You know, they're plowing the road, but it'll probably be chilly.
So. Yeah, right. Well, that's what people like these days, right?
Yeah, yeah. So. And, you know, bicycle riding is becoming, along the park roads, becoming a much more popular activity.
Seems like a really cool way to see it. And it's not limited. Yeah. You can buy, there's no, it's not like the bus. You have to buy a ticket. You can just show up and do it, right?
Right. You could just start riding. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Or you can put your bike on a bus and start at a farther point or work your way back, however you want to. There's several ways to kind of make that happen.
So going on one of these upcoming weekends is a good idea. There's going to be stuff going on, stuff for the centennial and so forth.
There will be, yeah. And then later in the summer, we've got a Denali staff reunion. And,
oh, cool. That will be neat, won't it?
Yeah, it will be.
I bet there's a lot of people you've known over the years. I mean, because
there's a lot of us old folks.
There's neat people who work there, but then also it's sort of a thing where people come and go, and you know, they work for Denali for a summer for a few years, then they move on somewhere else.
Right, right, yeah. So we're looking forward to that.
This is off. I'm sorry to change the subject.
No,
we'll get back to it. But is Denali considered to be sort of a plum assignment if you're a National Park Service employee? I would think it would be.
Yeah, yeah, it is. I mean, it's an old line park, 100 years old, lots of visitor activities, the mountain, of course.
It's kind of exotic.
It's in Alaska. So, yeah, it's got cachet.
Neat, neat. Okay, yeah. I'm sorry. Back to the stuff that's going on for the centennial.
No, well, the last sort of the big event in the fall is the road lottery.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a military appreciation day and then 4 days of open to general public.
Let's explain what the road lottery is for those who don't know.
So this is an opportunity to drive your own car as far west on the park road as you'd like to, in and out in a day. And it's a lottery you enter in the spring. We notify you if you are a winner. And and then you get a pass and are welcome to drive the park road. And it's, you know, the weather ranges from sometimes that, you know, glorious September fall weather to snow. And everything
been,
in
I've
between.
Been, I've been snowed on in August at Denali.
Right,
so,
right. Yeah. So it's, but it's a bit of a throwback to the way that Alaskans used to go to Denali, which was driving the long way around and in their own car.
Yeah. So what is the probability of winning one of those? I've always wondered, is it like 50-50 or is it like 1 in 100?
It's somewhere in between, but it's definitely not 50-50.
Yeah, okay, so it's a long shot.
Yeah, but the other thing is that, you know, you can, multiple family members can put in entries. You can combine the passes for a vehicle, so, you know, you can stuff a lot of friends in, so make friends with potential winners.
Cool. So is that the, so the opportunity to enter that lottery hasn't come yet, or is it still?
It has not come yet. Okay. I don't have... No, the date's offhand, but it's on, we mentioned the park website.
Check the website.
Lottery information would be there, yeah.
All right. Well, great. Lots of stuff happening for the centennial, and you can go to Outdoor Explorer, and you'll find the Denali National Park website, and sounds like a good time to rediscover the park. So a lot of what we hear, John Quinley, about the park these days revolves around various controversies that are taking place in the news. Obviously, the park is a huge economic engine for Alaska because these many hundreds of thousands of visitors go there, and they're spending money in our economy and employing people. And so we want to protect the park from that point of view. We also don't want it to be sort of loved to death, as we say. And then we also want there to be wildlife for them to see. And this has been a hot controversy because I guess some of the wildlife is misbehaving and walking outside of the invisible boundaries of the park and then, you know, getting into the whole system of game hunting and trapping, and that, from what I understand, has reduced the amount of wildlife there is to see in the park. So the Park Service has wanted to have a buffer. Is that right? Some kind of area where there isn't hunting around the park, or explain that situation to us.
Sure. Well, if you can visualize a map of Denali, and on the eastern end, just north of where you would turn into the main park road and headquarters and all, there's a notch out of there that's state land, the Wolf Townships, and that is never been part of the park. And wolves that frequent the eastern end of the park at times of the year, certainly more often in the winter, will move from inside the park to that area of state land north of the park. And there they, as you said, are subject to whatever state hunting and trapping laws allow. And what we found is that as more wolves are taken in that area, there tend to be fewer wolves denning in the area adjacent or relatively near the park road. And that results in fewer wolves being visible on the eastern side of the road, eastern end of the road, during the summer when the most visitors are in the park.
Do you have some numbers on that?
Well, there's wolf viewing success rates are down around 5-7% now.
Oh, wow. So like one in 20 people is actually seeing one.
Yeah.
And I've seen lots of wolves in the park.
And in the past, there have been, you know, those rates were several times higher than that.
Oh, wow.
And the overall wolf population in Denali, it's rebounded a little bit. It's in the 70s now. 77, I think, was our count from last fall. And, you know, in the past, it has been something over, typically over 100, you know, so it's on the lower end. It's not at the bottom, but it's at the sort of the lower side of the average for the total wolf population. But the visibility by park visitors is, tends to depend on the proximity of wolves to the road in the, particularly on the eastern half of the road.
I see.
So we count wolves across the whole park north of the Alaska Range, but there's
no people out there.
There's a lot of places where, people don't get to, or people not in the sort of numbers that traverse the park road.
Right.
So there have been.
Those wolves have been essentially are gone because of trappers primarily trapping for wolf pelts.
Right. They're trapping for pelts, and in places where It's legal north in that, mm-hmm. as I said, mainly in that sort of notch and state lands to the north and east of the park. There was, as recently as February, there were a couple of proposals before the State Board of Game to put a buffer zone back in, and those were voted down. And the one that the Park Service had proposed was based on radio collar data of where wolves that are most likely to den and spend most of their life in the park near the road, sort of where those also go in the winter, and to protect them in their winter travels, but not to make the buffer zone any bigger, you know, sort of based on the data than it needed mm-hmm. to be. As I said, the board voted that down, so there is no proposal now in front of the Board of Game.
And it'll be several years before it comes back.
It'll be probably 3 years at least before something comes back. Mm. There had been buffer zones in the past that the Park Service had a few years ago put a proposal before the board to expand that buffer zone. The board did two things. They voted down the proposal to expand, but then they also did away with the what had been the existing buffer zone. So there's been a lot of back and forth.
Yeah.
You know, the population of wolves in Denali is not in danger. There, as I said, there's, you know, our last count I think was 77. It's been lower. It's certainly been higher. But the visibility of wolves has become more of the
yeah.
issue.
Well, in general, as I understand it, this the habitat is not a super rich habitat for wildlife because it's generally alpine, and so it's not an area where you have like a very intense population of wildlife. It's just the fact that nobody hunts there because it's a national park, and because you've got this remarkable road that is animals are habituated to, and so you can see them. And so what we're sort of basing our economy to some extent on that, on those factors.
Right.
Yeah.
And I think it's, you know, what you described is certainly true. There, a lot of visitors do see other big game on their Denali trip. So they're,
I don't know that I've ever ridden the park road when I haven't seen a lot of wildlife. Right. Yeah.
So people are seeing caribou, they're seeing sheep.
I'm just saying it's not because it's like the richest habitat, it's because of the way it's managed.
No, interior Alaska, actually most of Alaska is pretty mm-hmm. lean habitat for, mm-hmm. for wildlife. And so it's not surprising that you don't have, yeah. you know, large herds wandering down the park road. People do see wildlife, but it's still a great treat to see wolves in the wild.
Right. Well, anyway, after 100 years, it seems like for the most part, Denali's pretty safe and in pretty good hands.
We like to think it is. It belongs to the people of the United States, and we hope we're doing a good job for them.
All right. And we should get out there and enjoy it this summer because it is a really special place. Well, thanks, John Quinley, for being here.
My pleasure.
Really enjoyed having you. John is the Director of Communications regionally for the National Park Service. Our producer here on Outdoor Explorer is Eric Bork. Hannah Duro is our assistant producer who lines up guests. My name is Charles Wolford, and I'll see you outside.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal, The Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and on iTunes. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.